Think I can make it done. Done was done.
You ready? Are you ready to go? Or are you just fucking around again?
I am ready to go.
Okay. So, 3, 4. Hello and welcome to Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes referred to as Monkey Boy.
Monkey
Boy.
And we are coming to you from close to the Nevada border, but not that close. You can see the Nevada border, or is that because of the strong peyote the tribal chief gave us?
I think it's the peyote.
We don't know. On today's episode, is it pronounced episode or ep-isode?
I always like to say show, but then I can get confused with other shows.
No, see, the show is the show.
It's the big, all the shows.
It's the big, the all the shows. As we're and the episodes are the little things inside of the show. It's kind of like, you know, the nucleus. Remember WKRP? The nucleus and then the nuclei and then the protons and the neutrons?
Yeah, yeah, and they orbit so far away they don't see each other.
Okay. I thought it would work, and it didn't. It just caused more confusion. But anyways, he had to go back to school, remember? Venus made him go back to school because he taught him the atom. I think it was the atom. Anyways.
It was probably the atom. Cause,
I remember the atom only when I see... I remember learning the atom only when I see a repeat of the episode.
I don't remember that episode.
That's exactly how we were taught the atom when we were in school. And all that stuff I forget until I see it.
Well, they didn't teach very well in school. You should have had Venus flytrap there to teach you.
Exactly. On today's episode, we continue our theme of American commercial... Sorry. We continue our theme of American commercial folk singer-songwriters in the male category. Very catchy. With a look at the short career of Jim Croce. And we will be reviewing his 1972 album, You Don't Mess Around With Jim, which was very similar to the original title of the album, which is... I don't want to do that joke.
Timing's
see
off.
See if I can ad-lib a little bit.
Timing's off.
Similar to the title, You Don't Mess Around With Horatio. See, that wasn't bad. I didn't like the joke I originally wrote. Rob, not all jokes are gold. I have to write so many jokes, and some of them just fall flat.
You know, isn't there some way of keeping them up to standard?
No.
Okay.
It depends on how late of the evening I'm writing the script.
The censor's gone to bed. Anything goes.
Before we get started, Rob, as you know, we have business to do.
I know. What business?
Why don't you tell everybody what the business we have this week?
This week we're starting our contest.
I've got to go down into the vault. Oh, we're down into the vault.
It's time for you to guess what we're doing next week.
I don't whatever even know. Week this I may have be. To read this again. It's quite a while. We didn't do a show when we were supposed to do it.
Yeah, last week was...
And I have the script already. So it's been quite a while since I've seen the script. Before we get started with... Before we have all the fun and good... You know that on this show, we have fun and good times.
Remember the last gardening show? We were always punching each other on the last show.
No, that was not true.
We don't do
that. On the gardening show, they don't have good times. They just talk about gardening. We have fun.
They have no good times or bad times.
No, but they get more people to listen, unfortunately. And also we got some... I want to send today. It's something personal. It's personal, Rob. I want to send a personal message to a person who won't hear this because she doesn't listen to the show.
Oh, right on. Those are the best kind.
They are.
That's all the people I know.
But maybe this will get around. Maybe it'll go from San Francisco and go all the way around and get back to her back here. Because what I want to say. I'm really going off. I shouldn't go off script because then I get lost.
I always find it's best to communicate people through mediums in which they cannot hear.
I want to say, and this is personal to you too, right?
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, it is. You know what this is about, don't you?
Yeah.
I like to fuck with Rob a lot. It's so much fun.
Business is coming.
Because he doesn't know anything what's going on at the show, except that maybe he listened to the album that week. Maybe he didn't. Who knows?
Business is coming.
I want to say to Rob's sister, Nikki, that the drum kit I lent to her sons is not hers.
Not hers and not his?
No. I know that you have the... This is a personal message right now. I'm speaking to her.
Yeah.
I know that you have the drum kit and you've had it for a long, long time.
A couple of years.
A very long time.
Yeah.
But when the time comes, and it will.
Uh-huh.
It won't be soon.
No, not soon. We've done our financial calculations and our new place won't be opening up for a few years yet.
That's right.
Yeah.
But when the time comes, I will want that drum kit. It is not your drum kit, Nikki. It is not. Even though it's been there for a god-awful long time. It is not your drum kit. It is mine. But now I do not want the drum kit back. Please don't give it back. I love that you have the drum kit. Oh, I just love it.
Don't give it back, but it's not yours.
I just want to emphasize that. I want the boys to enjoy the kit as much as I have enjoyed it over the years.
But always bear in mind.
But always think of it as my kid. And that's a heartfelt message from me to you. And from Rob, too.
It's a heck of a message. I got to give out some more messages like that. But I have no one to communicate with.
I didn't put the timer on. You're going to have to keep timer again.
By golly, we are... the timer's pretty much accurate on the computer because we only had a minute or so.
I can't see the computer.
No, I can barely see it myself.
there'll be no time today, unfortunately. No time.
But somehow the show will be an hour and 17 minutes.
Could you tell me right now, Rob, how far are we into this? See, the people know because they're listening and they're going, oh, well, there's 7 minutes into the show or whatever. Well, how much are we into the show right now?
Yeah, they got a computer display, which I can easily read.
I know that. Tell me how much.
We don't. We're a bit handicapped in that kind of
thing. Yeah, we are. So
we're at 6 minutes in.
Oh, okay.
6 minutes.
Which is right because I just hit one because I restarted it. Okay. So that makes 7 minutes, right? Okay. So 6 minutes ahead. So when I see my... People are tooting out right now to the garbage. when I see my timer...
Timekeeping device.
I just have to add six.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I see mine, it doesn't mean anything to me.
No.
Nope.
Oh, and I had a little sentence here, but I'm not going to say it now because I went right off topic. It was a good line, too.
You don't have to take our words for it. We've got some gold, but...
Yeah. No, I got to say, it kind of leads into... what I'm going into. So I'm going to try and sneak this line in somehow. You know, Rob, I'm really grateful for Nikki taking the drum kit and using it when we couldn't use it because we didn't have the space.
Couldn't keep it.
So I thank her.
Yeah.
I thank her very much. And to Rob's sister, Leanne, why are you such a ball breaker? I see, it wasn't worth it. My timing's off. But anyways, speaking of ball breakers, Rob, how was your week?
It was an uneventful week. I did a little bit of soul searching. I was kind of asking myself, what kind of person do I really want to be at this stage in my life? I couldn't find an answer, so I abandoned the question and went back to doing little or nothing for long periods of time. And then when I was done with that, I went to
sleep. Didn't I tell you about breaks? You know, you just don't go from the one big long sentence. You got to have the breaks. We talked about this last show, and you don't listen.
Well, I'd have to be prepared for something like that.
No, you don't have to be prepared. You just have to be. Just remember not to talk like it's some sort of competition.
Yeah, but I think speech of that nature, where you have breaks, implies that you have something to say. When has that ever occurred when you...
Odds and Ends, lost time is not found again. This week on Odds and Ends, Rob, we have a little correction from last week's show.
We made a boo-boo?
I did.
Okay.
One of my rare boo-boos, but I did.
It happens.
That's why we have this section called Odds and Ends, so we can correct our mistakes.
Yeah.
On our segment, I called James Taylor's guitarist an asshole.
No, I
didn't. I called him an ass.
And I wanted to call him a dickwad instead. No, James Taylor's guitarist's name was Danny Korchmar. And I called him Korch, and his nickname is actually, which I know this, and I don't know why I said that. His nickname is Cooch.
Cooch.
So I called him Korch, but his nickname is Cooch. I hope nobody is turning listening right now. As the first thing they're listening to, it's like, you gotta listen to this show, man. And I'm going, Korch and Cooch. What a bad first impression to make.
I don't know if I'd want a nickname like Cooch.
Well, that's his nickname, and he likes it because he's been using it for like 50 years. So it's none of your business whether he likes it or not, because he uses it.
Okay, I'll let him get away with it this time.
Yeah, you know, and I realized my mistake actually when I was driving home from the show, and it just occurred to me that, oh, it's not Korch, it's Cooch.
Cooch.
So to Danny, I apologize, and let's put this behind us, okay? Let's not make
this
a personal thing.
It was not intentional, as you might have thought.
It was not intentional. I love you. Well, I don't love you because I don't know you, but if I did, I would love you. I would love you too much.
And I mean that.
I saw your pictures and I would love you so much. Also, we have a couple of nice surprises in the next couple of weeks.
I don't believe it, but go ahead.
I can't tell you.
You can't tell us?
We don't. Or they would be surprises. I just said they were surprises, Rob. Well, I'm going to tell you one of them. Okay.
Okay.
So this won't be a surprise because I'm going to tell you this one, which is we have rehired our French correspondent Bora Bora.
Really?
Yeah. He was. If people don't remember. Bora Bora was fired from the show a while ago for being rude and belligerent about basically everything. But we have made amends, and he actually wrote something for this show about commercial folk singer-songwriters that was rude and belligerent. So we will not use in any way what he wrote, but he has promised to tone down his rhetoric and to be much more civilized. You spent a whole week with him in outside of Paris when you went on vacation.
And he was like civilized all the time. He wasn't talking.
he was fine.
But
you said it was one of the most painful trips you ever went on.
Well, he could be abrasive at times.
That's fact, one of the nicest things that you could say about Bora Bora is that he's abrasive.
There are a few times when he was not abrasive. Very few times.
When he was worse than abrasive. Okay. And we hopefully in the next, I don't know, couple of weeks, we will have a usable piece from him and we will use it on the show. But he kind of was mad at the show and we were mad at him. And because he's an easy guy to get mad at.
Yep.
And he's an easy guy to get mad at everybody else because he doesn't like anybody.
No,
except his
like
wife,
it.
Who he treats as like shit.
I say his rage knows no bounds.
We got him reporting on music, and yet he hates everything he hears. So that's one of the drawbacks. I told him, like, you have to start liking something. I mean.
Yeah, you're not much of a music correspondent if all music is bad. It's not really what we're pushing to our audience. Here's an album you might have thought it was good, but it's a stinker.
It's a stinker. Today, Rob, we are going to talk about the ongoing drama that is the progressive rock band Yes.
Ooh.
Now,
curious to hear this.
In a couple of weeks, I don't know when it's going to be. You can't pin me down because I got a lot on the run. I got a lot to do on this show. I do everything on this show except edit. So when I say I got a lot to do on this show, it's like fucking everything.
Everything. Yeah.
But we're also going to do about the ongoing drama of Pink Floyd, which is very acrimonious at the moment. Yep. Like it's always been.
Wait, is it Pink Floyd or Yes?
But today we're doing Yes.
We're doing Yes. Okay.
And I don't know if it's acrimonious. That's not a good word to use. It's just the what I said before. It's the ongoing drama of a band that really shouldn't exist anymore because there's just like nobody left. And there's nobody left in one way when I say that in physical terms. and there's nobody left in terms of they're not in the band anymore. Now, this sparked my interest to do this piece because I read two things. First of all, I read, this is not first of all, second of all, which was just recently, I heard that they were releasing a new album. In fact, when is the album being released? I don't know, sometime.
Sometime in the future.
They're releasing a new studio album called Mirror to the Sky. Oh, it says in May. I don't know when in May. I think by the time this show airs, maybe it's released already. I don't know when this airs. I got so many questions from people. Like, why don't they leave me alone? I don't know when the things air.
We make something up. That's what I do. I anyways, oh, soon.
The Yes album, called Mirror to the Sky, new studio album, will be released in May. And Steve Howe, the only, not even an original member of the band, but from the classic lineup, who's still in the band, calls it a very important album for the band.
Hey, wait a second. I guess at this age it kind of is, because it means they're not dead.
Any album released when you get to this stage is a very important album, as kind of Rob was saying. I think there's only four songs on the album, as usual. It's a Yes album, only four songs.
They're good long songs.
But, you know, then the second thing, which is actually the first thing. Don't try and follow me, because that's me. No. I don't know, a month and a half ago, I read a piece in Rolling Stone. They've been doing an ongoing series about lead singers who replace the front man, the archetypical front man of a band. And this one was on the Canadian Benoit David, who replaced John Anderson when John... that's a whole... I mean, Yes, it's a whole psychological, psychiatric book in itself about how this band operates. But John Anderson was kind of on leave because he had cancer. And then they decide, you know, maybe it's better if we fire you because you can't tour with us.
Your cancer's holding us down, man.
Basically, that was what it comes down to. And I remember reading that. I remember the day reading that, and I was going, how things have deteriorated when you get fired because you have cancer. Now, luckily, John Anderson has recovered from it. He actually formed a very, very good band, from what I understand, with Trevor Rabin and Rick Wakeman. I forget what they were called. Anderson, Wakeman, and Rabin, or something like that. And that resulted in a conflict with the other. Oh, there's so many conflicts in that band. But anyways, I think John Anderson is working on his solo stuff. He's a really cool dude. I had a chance to listen to the very first concert he did when he it was a solo concert. It was just him on guitar. It was beautiful. It was the first concert he did after he recovered from cancer, and it was in front of just family and friends at a small club in California. And he sang wonderful, and he sang all these old tunes, just like Yes tunes on guitar. And it was really cool. And he had except for the weaknesses that you get with age and everything, he sang really well. And it just beguiles me that the what goes on in this band. I have always bitched about things. I told you, I think, Rob, we did a segment on this, something where I told you that I had the, I don't know if I told you this in secret or if I told you on the show, but I had about 2005 or 2006, I had a really bad flu. And just by chance, the day before I got the flu, I took out this book from the library called Yes in Their Own Words. And it was basically all these interviews taken from Yes about their whole career. And it was pasted together. It was a fascinating book. I recommend it to anyone if you want to know about Yes. And all it was bitching. I liked that song on the album, but then... That classic quote about, but then, you know, we got into like Tales from Topographic Oceans, and all of a sudden Chris Squire is spending 3 hours just to tune his bass. And things kind of got it. We came about being a band, you know, from with Fragile and the Yes album and Close to the Edge to, like I said, spending a whole day just tuning instruments. And it just became kind of, I think Rick Wakeman said that or something. And it was just like, that's when I had to quit. It was like this band's out of control. And they kind of have been since then. They have their good periods when they kind of stay focused. So I was reading this article with Benoit David. And he had the utmost respect. He's out of the show business career now. It's quite interesting because he was another person who was in a Yes tribute band. Just like there's, you know, how a lot of replacements have come from tribute bands in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So he was in a French-Canadian Yes tribute band. I can't remember the title. It's in here someplace. And they asked him, you know, Chris Squire said, you know, do you want to replace for a while John Anderson? And he said, sure. What the heck? He didn't say it like that. He said it with more of a French thing. But that's what he said. And then he kind of, when you're in the kind of like the Yes pool of things, and you get caught up in that, there's a lot of like, you know, Yes. Let's lay it on the line. There's a lot of problems in Yes, especially in Chris Squire's last years, and we all miss Chris Squire. Everybody misses Chris Squire, both for his bass playing and for his personality. He was Yes, and to have what I was kind of getting to is to have an album, any album. They've already released one album without him, studio album, but to release another album without him to me is just incomprehensible. I'm all for people earning a living, but I think you can earn a living without putting the Yes name on something that you're making. That's all Steve Howe, because he's the only one calling the shots now. Anyways, a lot of this article talks about the problems that Benoit David had with Chris Squire, who he respected immensely, but Chris had some problems. As you could tell by his bloating of his body, as you saw at the end, Rob, like he got really big.
Yeah.
And he kind of let himself go, and he had problems with the drink and the drugs. And so a lot of times, and everything got critiqued from a concert. They would play a concert, and Benoit David would come off, and somebody would say, oh, you missed the high note on that. It's like, that's all you got to say. You know, I sang so well for 2.5 hours and you criticize this. And one of the things was Chris would always, if he was in a bad mood or something, always criticize him for hitting a couple of wrong notes or not hitting the high note on something. And Benoit would always say, you are really the last person to speak about having to hit the high notes or having to do what I have to do to make the band work, because you barely go to rehearsals. You don't practice when have time off. And you're just kind of doing what you do, you know, the bad stuff. And you're kind of letting yourself go, as you can tell by Chris's physical appearance by the time he was also getting near the end.
Not practicing in between tours and that, you kind of lose a bit of muscle strength in your hands. You
gotta get that was mentioned. That was mentioned. Mm-hmm. And just not, I wouldn't say not giving a damn. I'm not going to say that. But just not thinking
not
you don't need to. Thinking
as
not as focused enough because you got, your mind is cloudy from the stuff you're taking and you got your, you know, you're in your 70s and you've already got $1 million+ and you just don't have that hungerness anymore for it, but you still want to play the music. You kind of want to float through it is what you want to do. I want to do it because I love the travel and I love the playing.
But you're not going to have the energy to do it like you used to do it before, which was...
And that was really, and he really got, like, he enjoyed it so much, and he just really, he just came across, he did get he said with Steve Howe, which is strange because a lot of people don't get along with Steve Howe. There's the famous story about when they did the drama, not the drama tour, I'm sorry, the union tour. Remember when all the members of Yes came together and did the tour, and then they did the union album? Right. Late 80s, early 90s. And there was always, no, it wasn't that. It was, because Trevor Rabin, like, I don't think Steve Howe was talking to Trevor Rabin in the union tour or something like that. But it was actually when Trevor Rabin wanted to come out before they did that and guest with Yes and play Owner of a Lonely Heart. And Steve Howe says, no, I'm not playing that song. I don't want him on stage. I don't even want him backstage. And I'm not just knocking Steve Howe. I hear that the only real nice guy, you know, in Yes was like Alan White, the two drummers, Alan White, Bill Bruford, were always stand-up guys. Chris Squire, when he was like in his prime, and kind of John Anderson at the end. John Anderson can be a real prick because he always wanted his ideas and he was always talking about new age stuff, about his songs. I can imagine how that could be aggravating. But there were times when John Anderson was a real good guy. But the real prickly personalities, oh, and Rick Wakeman was the greatest guy in the band because he was the funniest guy. They say he could have been a stand-up comedian if he wanted
to. Did you see him when they at the acceptance speech?
Yeah, brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. It
That whole place came to life when he was
it did. It may have been the best speech I've ever heard at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was hilarious, and it completely took the pomposity of the evening, you know, it just exploded it. And it was his way of saying, don't take this shit too seriously, okay? It's only rock and roll, right? And I love Rick Wakeman. He's just great. And but you got all these really, you know, difficult people in this band. And you get that almost with every progressive rock band because you're talking about virtuoso players and incredible singers and songwriters, and I don't know if I would. First of all, I'm not a big fan of actually playing this music. I love progressive rock music, but I'm not a big fan of playing it. It's not the type of music that
I'd always wanted to play it, but I couldn't find, you know, four or five guys who could who were that good.
You did it with Rush, though, really good.
Yeah, you could find Rush three music. Guys who could play like Rush or Zeppelin or The Who. But you can't find...
In fact, it was because you played Rush so well that so many years ago, I don't even know how many years ago that was. Probably close to 40, because it was about 1984, 1985.
Yeah, high school.
Yeah, high school. That's why I wanted to get Rob. I saw him on our talent night in high school, and I said... And I wasn't even there anymore. He was in grade 12, and I was... Just went there because my friends wanted to go. So I said, oh, I'll go. And then I saw them and they were incredible. And they played Rush. And that was actually the first time I really got Rush. You had to actually hear Rush, even in with you three guys playing live. And I really kind of got it at that point. And that I had to get Rob.
Yeah, it wasn't like I was doing it. So,
what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that you're dealing with top-notch musicians, and they play difficult music. Oh, what I was saying was, I love to hear it, but I can't. I'm not enthused about playing it. I don't like. Rob knows this. Rob knows I like dynamics. I like if a song is going to be 8 minutes, it's because we're going up and down with music. I don't like it because there's a whole lot of different parts. That's Rob's bag, and he does that very well.
If I could do it more, I'd be happier.
But yes, you know what? If Rob, Rob would do, I think, if Rob could find the musicians that wanted to play that and were good enough, that's not my bag. My bag is listening to it, but not playing it. It doesn't interest me at all, except the thing that I really liked was when we reviewed the Miles Davis album. One of my favorite albums of Dark Magus. Yeah. And I said, I could do this. Because we do that a lot, actually. Not as good as Miles did. But we do that jamming with that funky thing and then just going for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And that I could do and just love it. But I just don't like all the parts and it has to be 20 minutes and it has to be, this has to come in. That's not my bag. I'm more of a John Lennon kind of guy.
It is a lot of it's cut and dried. There's not a whole lot of room for improvisation.
Yes.
Or, yeah, there's not a lot of room for improvisation or making stuff up or changing
the feel. And I love people that do it. And man, Rob, if he could do it, like if he could find the players, I know Rob would be incredible doing it. But it's just not for me. It's just not the kind of... I'm just more of a distorted guitar, let's go kind of guy.
Yeah, let's plug it and play.
And these people are a different breed. And I understand that. Like, these are top-notch musicians. Even if they haven't gone to school, a lot of these kids hadn't... You know, when they started, they didn't go to school. I don't know how these kids got so good. Like, 18, 19 years old, and then Chris and John form, yes. And then... How they get so good? Like fuck! I just don't understand that. It's, you know, I just feel sometimes you're just picked to be like that. God says that's what you're gonna be, and I'm gonna make you good because we need a band like Yes, you know, in the world.
They're not playing stuff that's normally played. Like they're making up different weird stuff that.
Yeah, they're making up stuff. They're inventing progressive rock as it comes. No, I don't want to get too much into this article because he didn't have any bad feelings about it. Except what I wanted to talk about is something that really bugs me about so many bands, especially the bands that come from the 70s and 80s, is that like when Benoit David was let go, you know, and I've heard this so many times from other bands when they've talked about it. He was let go with like a letter or something like that, or an email. And it's how this music has turned, and not seeing anybody, like going out on tour and you see them on stage
and go your separate ways.
Exactly.
Yeah, back in the old days, I mean, when you started a band, you wanted to bond with them, to become friends with them, and that makes better music.
That's why, that was one of the major reasons. You play it because you want to play your music, or you just want to play music that's original, or whatever your plan is. But the other 50% of why you want to be a musician is for, you got four or five other guys that have the same mindset as you, and you're always thinking that nobody has the same mindset as me, and yet you're always, and it's an incredible feeling to have, you come to the same place once a week to work on the material. And you're all in it.
Yes, it's so nice to be in a band where everyone's enthusiastic about that. No one's fighting one another.
Right.
About
no
that.
One's fighting one another. And no, we joking shouldn't do with
songs like that. We got to be like this.
It pisses me off is that I hear all this time about, I got let go with an email. They didn't even tell me. They just said they wanted to go a different direction. And it's very businesslike.
Yeah, that's what it was screening. It seems really corporate-y.
Yes, that's very grotesque. Corporate-y. I get that. I could do this whole piece again and talk about Journey. Journey, you know, I don't understand, and I'm going to get on a rant here, but I don't understand how these bands, I can maybe understand with Journey because I hate them with a passion, except for Steve Perry. I think he's just one of the best singers ever. But their music I really don't like, and I will admit it, and we will do an album, and I'll say I don't like it.
It's coming. That one will let you know about ahead of time.
But
you
apart
get ready for
from
it.
That, not only did we call them at the time corporate rock bands, and I'm sorry if they don't like it, but it's true, because that's music meant to make corporations money and to make them money. I don't see a heck of a lot of... We're doing this because we love it. And I may, you know, I could be wrong, but I really feel that way. Foreigner and all those other bands. They were so hated by rock and roll people like us when we were listening, you know, growing up at that time.
For the casual listener.
Yes, it was for not the serious rock musician who buys a whole bunch of albums. It's for the cat, and they, you know, Journey has millions and millions of fans around the world, and it's for a good reason, because their music appeals. But usually they only listen to like Journey or Foreigner or some of the two or three bands, and that's about it. They're not musical library like I would have in my head or anything like that, or like Rob would have. That's fine. I'm not knocking that. What I'm knocking is this whole business thing, and right from the beginning, this whole thing where, maybe not in the beginning, like what I'm trying to talk about is, I think there have been three lawsuits in the last 5 years between members of Journey, and then they go on tour together. And I say, well, how can you go on tour together when you're in the middle of a lawsuit? I'll give you an example. I think they're on tour right now, as a matter of fact. And Jonathan Cain, the keyboardist, was being sued by Neil Sean. Neil Sean likes to sue everybody in the band for some reason. And Steve Perry even sued. Steve Perry sued earlier in the year, 2022, he was suing because they were using songs that he has a right
to say. Well, we got writing credits on it.
Yes. So he has a right to say, well, you can use a song for this, but you can't use it for that. And he was consulted about some things. So they probably didn't listen to him, so he sued them. And then he dropped the lawsuit. I guess they came to some sort of agreement, and he dropped that. There are lawsuits all the time in that band. And it's not just them. I could go on and on. There's Aerosmith. Aerosmith sues each other all the time. Who gets into a band I'm getting really worked up because it really you shouldn't be in a band anymore when
That's not a band. No. That's a bunch of musicians hanging out together and working together, but that ain't no band.
That's a job.
You guys are not banded together.
That is a job. That's all it is. Yeah. And everybody, and I'm not joking, everybody has their own lawyer. Because I seen it when I read in Rolling Stone that, you know, Journey was having trouble. Oh, and I read it about Aerosmith when Joey Kramer wasn't allowed to play with the band at some sort of thing that they were getting an award for. And they felt that his playing wasn't up the chops because he had a problem with his hand or something. And he said, no, I'm well enough to play. And so he sued them. Said, listen, I'm an original member. I've been playing in this band for like 50 years. And then that's when I heard his lawyers contacted Steve Perry's or Joe Perry's and Steven Tyler's lawyer each. And I'm going like, everybody in every band has a lawyer for themselves. You should have a lawyer for the group. Yeah. Because you're all fighting to get... But that's not what they're fighting for anymore. You fight to get your name out there, and as a band, it's us against the world and everything. And then it becomes, you got all this money, and then it becomes, you get a lawyer so that everybody else doesn't screw you in the band.
A lawyer is basically the modern day equivalent of a stick you can use to hit your neighbor with if he gets out of hand.
It's so true.
And now we got bands hitting each other with sticks.
It's all over the place. And it's all over the place with the bands we grew up with in the 70s, which makes it even sadder. And that's what I'm talking about with Yes. I haven't seen too many lawsuits with Yes, to be honest with you. But there's always dissension. There's, you know, I thought that actually the band would end, not only did I think it would end with Chris Squire, which of course it didn't, because they're money-hungry pigs, who's left. But then Alan White, who's like the sweetest, nicest guy in the world, unfortunately passed away. And everybody was very sad. And I thought, like, Alan White was really the heart of that band, because he was like the glue that put all these egos, you know, in check. And then when he died,
he is the most consistent member since 73.
Chris Squire since 1973. Yeah, other than Chris Squire, he's the one that's been there the longest. And when he died, he was, because when Chris died, he took over as being the longest standing
member. Yeah.
And I thought, well, that would be the end. And then when I see that this new album's coming out, I said, you know, that's just a corporate album. I mean, that's just an album so that you can tour more, so that you can make more money. Yeah. I have nothing against making a living, but I do have something against putting out pure product.
Content.
And using a name that is associated to me with, especially John Anderson and Chris Squire, and they're not on it. And one of them are still alive. I wish John Anderson had the ability, which he doesn't, because, you know, Chris Squire had the name and he was probably got passed down to Steve Howe. And he doesn't have the veto power to say no. And he's, John Anderson's a nice guy. He probably said, if you want to release albums, what do I care? I'm not in the band anymore. I could care less what you hacks
could
do.
You go do what you do.
And yeah, and it's just... I guess what I'm getting at is this problem with Yes and their continuing dramas is not a singular issue. It's something that permeates these, when you got lawyers, and I'm not just talking about these old bands, I'm talking about, your Rihannas and your Beyoncés and their litany of lawyers that they have, five lawyers. I said, why are you in this? Like, why do you want to do this, to make as much money as you possibly can? Are you in this, like, yeah, I want to talk to, I can't get to the, I my problem is, Rob, I can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around to the point
they've
where.
Already got everything. They're good. They shouldn't be so uptight. But here they are worse than ever.
We're worse than ever. I can't imagine myself saying, I want to talk to Rob. I'm going to call his lawyer and tell him what I want to say before we go.
But for humor purposes.
For humor purposes, I can see it. But I could actually not say, because saying I lived in, I don't know, Vancouver or something, and you lived in Nassau, Bahamas or someplace, or Thailand or whatever, and I said, you want to get together, because that's okay. I mean, you can live in different places, right? As long as you get together and it's a friendship, and all of a sudden, you know, you may not see each other for 4 months, you took 4 months off, and then you see each other and you work on another album, and then you go on tour, and that's fun. But when it's like you're calling and say, I got some songs, and tell Rob that I got some songs, and to get the guys together, and I'll tell the other guy's lawyer to get. I mean, that's just, to me, ridiculous. I can't even fathom that.
No, we have enough trouble with band practice. You have to call Mike, and I have to call Carter. And
We
have to get in touch with each other.
It would be different if we were making millions of dollars. I mean, there'd be no trouble getting band practice together for making millions.
Yeah, because we just have
dollars.
One lawyer, and he could get in touch with all of us at once.
Yeah. That's what you're supposed to have, as a lawyer to represent the band. But it then gets to be, well, Rob's got his millions, I got my millions, and I'm protecting mine, and I'm protecting my interest in the band, and all of a sudden, I'm, you know, conversations are happening between lawyers and not band members, and the Stones do it.
Yeah, and you also have to remember that the lawyers, they got to make a living too. I mean, I know all about how divorce lawyers fuel the fires of...
I'm not knocking the lawyers, because the lawyers are being hired by the musicians.
Yeah, but I'd like to, in my mind, think that they're impartial and objective, and
they're not.
But you know,
they're not, because they're representing their guy, so they could lie too to get more work. To get more work.
Yeah.
And well, as far as getting a lawyer, that's not up to the lawyer. Doesn't call like Joe Perry and say, hey, you need a lawyer. How about you get me? That's up to the musician. The musician's saying, like, it got to the point where, I don't know when this happened, when everybody decided to lawyer up. And
if I were a lawyer, I could see myself saying to a musician, you know, that thing you just said, you going to take that?
I can see that. It happens. Sometimes you don't want... They had that in the movie Almost Famous, in a way, where... They finally got a manager who was played by Jimmy Fallon, who did a great job, the band in the movie. And the manager, Jimmy Fallon, was kind of making overtures to make the band the way he wanted it. Like, oh, you know, he doesn't like that. And why is this? And then he put certain people in the front of their merchandise, you know, because he wanted, you know, sticking commercially. And whereas the band would not do that, the band would have four guys standing together, right, for a band T-shirt. But now the manager, who's just thinking about money wise, thinking, well, this is the guy's popular. Put him up front. Put the guys in the back, and the guys in the back, of course, are pissed off. That's how you get the divisions in the band sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all the time, because you know bands. I don't know. Sometimes I'm so happy I was never famous, because I could never, it's not my dream of being in a band that's a corporate entity. It's just not my bag. I would quit so quickly in that. It wouldn't be funny. And it's just starting all over again and playing clubs, because I just couldn't do it. I would have my millions and I would say, you know what? This is not what I want. And they're holding on to such dear life for this name. They're all holding on for their name, whether it be Aerosmith or Yes or Foreigner, or I could name so many bands, the Rolling Stones. They're all holding on to the name. They're not holding on for the friendships or to the making the music together. They're holding on because they want to play their music. They do want to play the music, But they want to play to as many people as possible. And if I did it on my own with Neil Sean and his band, I'm going to be playing county fairs all the time. But you know what? If you're having fun,
yeah,
it's more important than just getting together and playing in front of 15,000 people and not talking to the guys, or just talking to them just before minutes before you go on stage and then you take your home and leave.
I'd rather go through time playing music with friends than with associates.
And we're not done with this, because we're going to talk about Pink Floyd in a couple of weeks. And that's a whole other kettle of fish. That is, like, I heard about Pink Floyd when I was in the late 70s. About their troubles.
Which one's Pink?
About their troubles. Like, this goes back to the late 70s, and it has gotten 600,000 times worse than I ever thought it was. And I wanted to talk about that, so we will talk about that in a couple weeks. Man, that is, I can't even go into that. You said about which one's Pink. That actual issue was put aside. Now it's just, I don't like him, and I don't like him. And it's like, it's just people just not liking each other. And it's really sad. That's not a case of corporate. That's a case just of what we're going to get into when we do it.
Simple hate.
Simple hate. And we're going to get into that.
That's like Ray and Dave Davies. Just simple hate.
It is. That's why it's separate. That's why we're doing Pink Floyd separate from the other bands like Yes that we're talking about. Because this is not about money with Pink Floyd. This is about personal vendettas, and it's interesting, but it's incredibly sad. Anyways, leaving that was kind of like part one of our discussion of crazy bands. Oh, bands are so crazy.
Yeah, they started off with a good idea, but then they get weird.
Okay. Again, I can't understand that. I can't understand like it devolving into something like separate limos to things. That's when I would immediately think, I got to get out of this, because that's nothing about what I wanted to be of. I don't care about the money.
I want to have money to not starve and live indoors. That's nice.
Cared about was enough money to be able to do it. That's all we cared about. And I think that's pretty much what we got, and less. But you know what? Overall, except for one instance, we've kept friendships pretty good around us. And that's mostly what counts with me.
Yeah, people have come and gone pretty much as they were able to play.
I always made it, because I had people say, you should fire this guy. You should fire that guy. I'm not going to name names. And I would always say, no, he's my friend. And that's more, I know what he's capable of. I'm not stupid. I'm the leader of this band. I know what's going on. But you know what? I want people that I get along with, mm-hmm. rather than having a great guitar player that's an asshole and being very famous. That was more important. I wanted to have fun playing music.
Yeah.
And as me and Rob, which is ironic, because at the end, it wasn't fun.
Yeah. See, if I want what I do to survive, to be a drag, I've already got a day job for that.
Yeah, that's
easy.
I think, I don't know if we ever said this on the show, because we've said this to ourselves many times, but when we started, it was our dream just to be in a band, and to be in a band was everything. It was like heaven. And then after 30 years, and about the last five being anguishing, like completely like going to a job, if not worse.
Like when you get a sick feeling in your stomach before you go.
Seriously, like a sick feeling in your stomach if you ever had to play a gig or rehearse, because you knew you were going to have some sort of disagreement that wasn't going to end good. And it was just not a healthy atmosphere. Then at the end, that dream that you how much you wanted to be in a band, like, was the thing that you wanted. To not be in the band was the greatest thing that you could hope for. And seriously, like, it really was. And we were so happy
when we left
the band, because we didn't have to deal with that anymore. Now it was just me and him doing our ideas that always got quashed by other people in the band that had other ideas, even though they had no right to say it because it was our songs. And we were ecstatic for what 35 years earlier would have been terrible, which was not to have a band.
My God, we're finally not in a band. Wow.
So we got to get to the album here, because again, we're going to have a live show. Where am I?
Jim Croce.
Where am I? I know.
Well,
where
that's
am
the I guy, at? Jim Croce. Oh, yeah.
We feature in today's spotlight, Rob. I should not do that. That's terrible.
Rob with our artist.
It's like you're falling asleep. He's not. He's just, I don't know why I do that. We spotlight the music of the late Jim Croce and his 1972 album. You don't mess around with Jim. He's mad. He's crazy. That's not the full title of the album, but I'm pretty much that's what he's thinking.
Extrapolating.
I am extrapolating. You don't mess around with Jim. Jim Croce, of course, will always be remembered, unfortunately, for dying young in a tragic plane crash. Before, like, it's funny because his music has always been in our lives because he died before we were really into music at all. So, you know, I don't know how. I know it was devastating, but we don't know because we weren't there.
Yeah.
It was.
I only ever had to. I found out about it afterwards. Like, I mean, I had to read up on it to find out.
Yeah, exactly. So almost sort of like, oh, you heard about it on the radio when they would play the songs. They always seem to say it, like, oh, how sad he died.
Yeah.
It always seemed to get brought up. And that, unfortunately, has kind of overtaken his music. His music still gets played all the time, but it's always like, oh, he's just, I'm so sad how he died. And it is, but I don't, it's, you should be judged by how you live, not on that.
Shut up and play the music.
Yeah, you know, like.
Everybody knows he died young.
Yes, why is it just.
Jim Croce. That was a great song. But how about that mustache? Wasn't that a great mustache?
I love that mustache, eh?
That's what they should
I think be. It is kind of sad that's, you know, because of one extremely unfortunate plane ride after a gig, that's what you remember, like, for like. I don't even know how long, because the I'll get to how I'll get to
every time he got played. That's what got mentioned.
Yes, but on all those, yeah. But you have to imagine that, and this is hard to imagine because it is, because we weren't there at that time. But he, because it seems like his music was a stream of music, but he released his commercial first album. He had a couple of albums released before that were. Didn't do anything, and he released one with his wife and one he released by himself for just his friends. This was his first on a major label. That was in this album, what I'm talking about, was in early 1972. And you have to remember, he was gone by September of 1973. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing short time to be in the spotlight and then gone. And it didn't, you know, in all these years that I've been listening to music, it didn't really hit me, Rob, until I kind of did the work this week, and I was kind of like, oh man, like, I never thought of it that way. I knew, like, the time period, but when I really thought about it, it's like, wow, that's like 18 months and that's it? But that's incredible when you think about it, because imagine having 18 months and to produce three albums and everlasting three albums, music.
That's the thing that that was impressive. Because that's three, impressive. From what I know, good albums. I've heard this one. This is, well, we'll get on that. But definitely a good album. Definitely a good album.
What were you saying?
Three albums. I'm suspecting the other two were really good too.
So. Yeah. So Jim Croce, he started as a folk singer. His parents came from Italy. He was 100% Italian.
He grew up in a big Roman, big Italian neighborhood.
You could say that. I don't know if he did. But he grew up outside of Philadelphia. And, you know, he was a student disc jockey at the local, what do you call that?
Them college radio stations.
Very good. He knows what he always knows what I'm trying to say. At a college radio station. And he did not really take music seriously until he started at Villanova, which is a college outside Philadelphia. And then he started performing at fraternity parties and coffee houses around Philadelphia. And He released his first album in 1966, and that would have made him about 23 years old. And it was called Facets, and he himself, which is what I did for our first album, well, I did for every album, he made 500 copies himself, which means he paid for it, he paid to have it recorded, which was uncalled, you didn't do that back then. Because you had so many records. You just didn't do that. Like, independent record companies just weren't really a thing all that much. And it wasn't even an independent record company. It was just him. It says, I want to make an album. And so I'm going to do it. Just like I did. I want to make an album. And there's nobody to sign us. So we're going to make our own. And he did. And it financed it for $500. Which is a total in... around $4,500. That's a lot of money in today's dollars.
Yeah, that's a fair bit back then. That's a lot of
money back then, $4,500. It's amazing that $500 equals $4,500, isn't it? Wow.
Yeah, I believe it, though, yeah, because inflation's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing. It's lovely. And he got that as a wedding gift from getting married from his parents, and he used that money to make the album. They gave him a condition that will give you the money as a wedding gift, but you have to make an album, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. You know that? My parents usually gave him I get the encouragement in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Rob, I'll give you this money, but you can't do with it anything with music with this money.
God bless the humans I live with.
They had actually hoped that he would give up music after the album failed. So there was a little bit of a motive there to make him spend the money on the album, because they were expecting it to fail, which it did, of course, because he only made it for his friends and everything, and that he would get into a respectable profession. Oh, it says the album proved a success. I guess success didn't mean that he sold every copy to his friends, so he kind of made money from it. You sell 500 copies, they even say for like $3 each.
He got some airplay, didn't he?
For his first album? No, I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't even know he had a first album. I knew he made an album a long time ago. I knew he made an album with his wife in the late 60s, early 70s. But I did not know that he made a solo album long time before he got a record contract. I did actually not know this. And that's when he married his wife, right after that, in 1966, Ingrid. And then they started performing folk music as a duo. And he was a big fan of Ian and Sylvia and Gordon Lightfoot. He was a huge fan of Gordon Lightfoot. You know, Arlo Guthrie, all the folkies. And then in 1968, like I said, they were encouraged by record producer Tommy West to move to New York City and record an album, which they did for a big company, Capitol Records. Doesn't get much bigger than Capitol. And but the album didn't do... Now, I know this... I said the last album didn't do good, but it sold all its copies. What I meant was, like, it didn't hit the national charts or anything like that. He just got rid of all his albums. Like, all his friends and families bought it. And, but his album with his wife didn't do anything. And then he had to start taking jobs such as driving trucks, construction work, and teaching people guitar lessons and stuff like that. And then... the Croce's moved back to Philadelphia. I know this is long, but I think it's important to describe this because his life wasn't long, so we're not getting into it. But he returned to Philadelphia, and in 1970, he decided, I'm going to be serious about this now. You know, I've had all these crappy jobs. This is what I want to do. And so that's when he got together with Maury Mulheisen. Who is a very good guitar player, has a solo album, by the way, that I hear is very good, and I've seen on Discogs before he met Jim Croce. So he was very talented. As he was the lead guitar player, Jim would play the songs and
do the rhythm with
the singer. and Maury would do the tasteful lead guitar parts. You don't hear them too much on this album. You really don't. I don't know why. You don't hear much of the music on this album. But there are instances that you do, and when
they were still finding their groove.
Yes, exactly. I think they met very, very soon before this album. Anyways, you know, eventually he got signed to which record company, Rob? You remember?
The one with the big flamingo.
I don't know which one that is. It's a good ad lib, but. A&M? ABC.
ABC.
Yeah, I knew it was an A in there. ABC Records. And that's when he really released what we'll consider his first album, which is the one we're reviewing today, You Don't Mess Around With Jim, which was released... it was released. I got that information on another page, so screw you people. In 1972. And then he released... And he made a lot of concert appearances. He played all the time, but he played on the Dick Cavett Show and the Tonight Show and the American Bandstand and the Midnight Special. I remember him hosting the Midnight Special because they would repeat it a lot and show clips from that. They still do. It's on YouTube. And then he made his album, Life and Times. Which was released in late 1973, Rob? Do you remember?
Early 70s. I wish I could pin it down a little better for you, but that time was foggy for me.
In July 1973, actually, he released Life and Times in July 1973, just 2 months before his death. And then after he died, he released they released an album that he had already finished posthumously, which is I Got a Name, and that was it. 18 months and 3 albums, and I will tell you that before we, because we're just going to review the album, I'll tell you what happened. They played all the time. Like, they played from the time that they started with the record being released in early 1972. They played, him and Maury played all the time. And so they were playing some really small places that are cities I've never even heard of, second on the bill, but they were very popular because their songs were, every time he released a song, it went number one. Imagine that, how talented you are to, in a year and a half, have all these hit singles all the time. I mean, it's not easy to have a hit single. It's just not. And what happened is that they were playing a gig on the night of Thursday, September 20th, 1973, at a university in Louisiana, I think. I know that it crashed in Louisiana.
It was. Because he was taking off.
Yes, yeah. You're right, Rob. He was flying to Sherman, Texas for a concert at Austin College. And this is very interesting because what happened was the plane... Now, there's still not... A complete 100% affirmative of what happened. The plane took off, just like with Buddy Holly's, it kind of took off and not too long after it crashed. And this time it hit a tree
taking off
in the dark. Very soon in the dark. Some people say that the pilot had a heart attack and hit the tree. Other people say that as soon as they took off, they hit kind of like a black hole of darkness, which
can disorient you when you're flying.
Oh, very much so.
You don't have a sense of up and down.
See, like, I think Rob knows more about this than I do.
What's his name? That the one, the Kennedys there, who crashed.
That's, I believe, right.
He flew into a storm, and
that's right.
They believe he lost his up
you,
and down.
You lose. What's the word? You just lose. It's a, they call it actually a black hole, and it's nobody's fault. And you just fly up, and as soon as they flew up, they hit this fog and mixture of fog and clouds, and it's a black hole. You can't see nothing, no matter how good a flyer you are. You can't see anything.
We're on the ground; it's easier for us to judge which way up and down is with absolute certainty because we're not moving. But when you have the G forces of a plane pushing you,
right,
you really have to rely on your instruments more and your eyes.
Yeah. Until you get out of that black hole, which unfortunately, because it's a takeoff, you don't have that luxury of hitting a black hole like in the sky and then you can wait till it passes and you don't see. Unfortunately, it just happened really quick. It took off, can't see, hit the tree, and everybody's gone. Maury's gone, Jim Croce's gone. Everybody in that plane is dead. And it's just a sad accident. And the saddest thing about it, oh, here it is with the black hole. And I don't know about this. A later investigation placed the sole blame on pilot error because of his downward takeoff into a black hole of severe darkness, which is exactly what Rob said, limiting his use of visual references. Now, I guess they're blaming him for taking off in that, but I don't know if you can actually see that there's a black hole of darkness unless you hit it.
There should not have been a tree that close to the end of the runway. I've crashed a few times like that in my Grand Theft Auto simulations. Just saying. Those little runways.
Actually, I understand what you're saying, Rob. I don't mean to laugh like it's funny.
Those runways are not great.
But at first I thought, well, that's funny. Then I was thinking, you know what? That's actually a good approximation of what it's like. And there should not have been a tree there.
Yeah, because the amount of takeoff runway you need to take off to a speed where you can lift off, it can also vary with temperature quite a bit.
Yes.
I know planes in cold weather conditions can get off the ground very quickly. Planes in warm weather conditions near the equator can sometimes take up to twice as long.
And they say there was fog and there was clouds and that, you know, when it's fog, that's coldness.
Yeah.
That's coldness, you know. Yeah. And I understand. I guess you can say pilot error. I don't. I would not, being of course a flight investigator, I would call this just a really, really unfortunate accident.
Yeah.
And anyways, he was gone. But you know what? He made such good music that it lives on. And that's all you can really ask for if you're a musician. What I was saying, the sad part is, of course, other than him dying, was that he wrote a letter just before he died to his wife saying that he didn't want to do this anymore.
So yeah.
He hated traveling. He hated being away from his son.
The really awful part.
She got the letter after he had passed, which means he must have wrote it maybe even that day, who knows, and then sent it away. And saying that he wanted to write short stories and write film scripts and that he was done with the music business. He said, it's not what I want. And he probably would have done albums because he had so much music in him.
Yeah.
That he probably would have done albums. But the occasional small tour.
Touring.
The bullshit.
Being away from the family all the time.
Being away from a young son.
You don't have to. Don't do it. Like, why?
Yeah, exactly. And I know that he probably felt like this ain't worth it. As many times that I go, that you just hit a wall with things and you say, you know what, this is a pain in the neck and it's not what I expected.
Yeah, it's
to be.
Not what we set out to do.
And having hit singles and money is just not, it's not worth being away from my baby boy for a year and a half. I'm never home.
And also with the album sales, he also now had the confidence to know that he could do that.
Yes, so. He had the money. He had the confidence. He knew that if he did run out of money, he could make another album. That he knew that he had those songs in him. Very sad. When I read that, I did not know that. I saw the behind the music of Jim Croce, and for some reason, it never came up or I forgot it. But very sad. I mean, the whole thing's sad, and I guess that's why it lives on to this day about his death. As we said earlier, being so much a part. Too much a part of his legacy, because it is so sad. So let's get to the album.
Enough sadness.
First of all, we should get to the album. Yeah.
We're traveling back to a time before Jim Croce passed
we
away.
We are.
Everything's
we are.
Good.
And because we're running out of time, we're really over time.
Watergate hasn't happened yet.
There was Watergate.
This was a stinker.
This was difficult for me because the question that's always brought up and that I read a couple of times and I foolishly got involved in this when I was kind of listening to this album was, is Jim Croce a legendary figure because of his music, or is he a legendary figure because he died young in death. Such a tragic way? And I was grappling with this as I was listening to this album for a week. And I decided at the end it didn't matter.
I decided it's probably a combination of the two things.
It's probably a combination of two things. First of all, you can't have that many singles.
Yeah,
in such a short period of time, two or three without singles incredible per album. Amount of talent.
Yeah.
Yes, I love his singles. Let me preface that. I'm not a fan of his upbeat music. I don't.
Oh, he's faster, more. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Like I have never. I think I liked "You Don't Mess Around with Jim" the song, like maybe the first couple times I heard it, because it's very catchy. But not much after that. And it's painful because I've listened to it. It comes on the radio all the time. I've listened to it a million times. But it does nothing for me. It absolutely does nothing. And it's the same thing with Bad Bad Leroy Brown. It's just his upbeat songs really don't do nothing for me. I just don't. They're kind of lightweight to me. He is, in a way, I will tell you this, he is a soft rock performer. He's a soft folky. He's like... I've been trying for a week to not sully his memory, because I do like him as a songwriter. I do. I wish I could write like him. Operator is a brilliant song. It's a brilliant song. Time in a Bottle is a brilliant song. Time in a Bottle is one of the most saddest songs I've ever heard. Put it in the context of he's died. And that's an interesting story, too. I will really quickly put an addendum here, and that was not released as a single on this album. It was released as a single right after he died, because his fans requested it all the time when he died, because that song symbolized, well, the whole song, Time in a Bottle. I wish I had time in a bottle. I could do all these things I want to do. And so they released it as a single because it got requested. And it was like, that was their way of remembering him. But when you listen to it now in that context, it's amazingly sad. Oh, it's amazingly sad.
It's a sad song without it. But
it's a sad song without it, let alone the context.
Yeah, in context, I kind of stopped wanting to listen to it too much, because it was too powerful.
It is too powerful. It is actually too powerful. It really is. I loved Photographs and Memories. New York's Not My Home. I'm in a conundrum, because there's not a bad song on this album.
No,
he hasn't written a bad song on this album, and I'm guessing probably not a bad song on his other two albums after this. The thing is, it's not really for me.
Not yours. So, yeah, okay.
It's for the upper... of course, I'm in my 50s. What I'm talking about is... It's this music at the time was meant for people in their early 30s that had families and loved to have that music in the background and was great. People are going to think that I'm knocking him, but I'm not, because every music has its place. And his music was meant for the kind of life he had led, which is he was a guy in his early or almost 30. And it was meant for those kind of that don't take music too seriously, but they like to have it. And this Jim Croce is the kind of guy you would buy. Oh, I only got like 4 albums, but I'm going to buy this Jim Croce album or his singles because they're so good. And I like to hear them in the background, and it's great to play with my wife or my date.
Yeah,
or whatever.
There's nothing screechy or dangerous or offensive there, and it's not too soft.
Exactly. It's in right in the middle. It's folk, but it's not like...
It is exactly in the middle of the road.
It is middle of the road. Nothing wrong with that. Does that make him a legendary figure? No, but I don't think it matters. I think what matters is that he was an incredibly talented songwriter. He was a very good singer. He really emoted what he was talking about in his songs, maybe more than anybody. I've never heard anybody really cover his songs, to be honest with you, because I don't think they're all that coverable. I think he kind of did it, and that was the blueprint, that either you go by that or you fail, and nobody really wants to try.
No, and also his singing style on some of the faster songs is kind of unique to him. I haven't heard anyone else sing like that. He uses his voice it's a rhythmic instrument. There's kind of a skip to his singing, and it really dictates the feel of the song. And I don't hear too many people like singing like him.
I agree.
They could, but...
I agree. I like New York's Not My Home. I'm looking at the titles now. See, the songs I...
New York's Not My Home. What was the one right after Time in a Bottle? Post Office Number... Box Office Number 10?
Box Number 10 is a good song.
Yes, love that song.
See, the songs I don't... The songs that really don't have an effect on me are the up-tempo songs. You Don't Mess Around With Jim. Hard Time Losing Man.
I like Rapid Roy.
I didn't like that
either. I like the lyrics at Rapid Roy. Oops.
I thought... It just didn't do anything for me, Rob. I'm sorry.
Okay, no.
And for some reason, "Hey Tomorrow," the last song, didn't seem to. But I really like when he got into that soft rock mode. It just got to me. It was like, this guy's got a talent. It's not my thing that I would buy an album from him. Like in 1973, if I was like 18 years old, I would not buy a Jim Croce album, because I would probably buy the single. You know, because that was,
yeah.
People are probably wondering, well, most people that listen to our show knows what singles are, but a lot of people didn't buy singles by the early 70s.
Yeah,
but
I probably would. They no longer had jukeboxes.
I just love, I have heard his hit singles, except for the ones I don't like You Don't Mess Around With Jim and Bad Leroy Brown. I don't like those songs. And I don't mean I don't like them. I just, they don't do anything.
They don't appeal to you. Yeah.
They don't appeal to me. I don't get that rush of adrenaline that other people get when they hear those songs. But I tell you, I hear songs like, I'd buy his greatest hits. This is one of the few artists that I would buy his greatest hits album. And you know that we both hate greatest hits albums. But I would. And I would be happy buying it. And because I think Operator is just a brilliantly written song. I think Time in a Bottle is brilliantly written. I think it's, you know, Photographs and Memories. By the way, almost all of his songs are less than 3 minutes long, which is actually, depending on how you look at it, a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know. It makes for a quick album, but I kind of enjoyed it. I think he's that kind of songwriter that he doesn't fool around much with his songs. I'm trying to think of the other. I Had to Say I Love You in a Song, a beautifully written song with great lyrics that really encapsulate what it's like to be in a relationship. You know, I Got a Name, again, those songs really get to me. I never get bored of them, and I've been hearing them for 40 plus years now when they come on the radio. I never turn it off. Those songs really get me, just like the songs on here, New York's Not My Home, all that stuff. Welcome Back to Georgia. It's just that it's meant for kind of a yuppie crowd before the yuppie crowd was there in the 80s. It was kind of meant for that, you know, I'm going to my work job, and kind of meant for my brothers and sisters who weren't music fans but bought like two albums a year maybe. They were meant for those type of people. And that is not a criticism. It's just saying that there are different types of people that buy and listen to music.
Different audiences. You can still recognize something as good.
And he had talent. Even though. Yes. You can still recognize talent. And there's so much talent here. And it's just in a different... We have three very different songwriters that we're doing in this singer-songwriter. And they do things in extremely different ways. And Jim Croce does his in his way. It's amazing. You think about folk music, you just pick up an acoustic guitar and you write. He says, no, no, we have, you know, I'm not going to say next week's person is, but James Taylor does it completely different from Jim Croce, who does it completely different from the guy we're doing next week. And it's, I'm glad we do it, because it's woken up my eyes a little bit when you put all those three together.
Yeah.
And you see, this is nice, compact. He knows where he wants it to be, 3 minutes long. And he says what he wants to say, and then he's done. And they're very moving songs, and I've said way too much because Rob has things to say. I give it 3 stars, by the way. I would never buy this. It's not a criticism. It's just that there's so many records. If you put myself in 1972 or 1973, there's so many records to buy. I would love to have just one album of his greatest hits, which I'm serious, I would buy. In fact, I would probably buy it on a CD and have it, because I love Jim Croce. I've just never bothered buying his stuff. It's not a sin sometimes to buy greatest hits albums, And I would, but his albums in general are just too, a little bit too soft rock for me. Soft middle of the road.
See, in this case, you'll listen to the Greatest Hits album, but you probably won't be playing these start to finish too often.
So. Exactly. That's my point. Yeah.
I like this album. I really liked his songwriting. I definitely liked his, like I say, his singing is the most rhythmic I've ever heard from.
It is very rhythmic, isn't it?
Yeah, like
it's almost like an instrument. And you don't mess around with your gym. It is like an instrument, which a lot of people cannot say when they sing.
I thought it was a good album, even without the lyrics. But after reading the lyrics, I thought it was a really good album.
Yeah, he's very smart. Very smart lyric writer.
There's one or two, like, what was the last song? Hey Tomorrow?
Yeah.
That one, lyrically, I couldn't get into too much because I thought it was a little weak lyrically.
That's why I didn't like the song.
A bunch of the others were very strong lyrically, so.
That's why it was strange, because Hey Tomorrow was one of the ballads on the album. It was probably the only one that I didn't like. And I think it was, sounded, to me, it sounded like the last song that I have to put on the album. And I don't have much left. wrote this song.
I'm tired. Let's get this done.
Not that he rushed the recording of it, but the writing of it, it just seems like it didn't have the panache that the other 11 songs had. And it kind of was you want a big ending. It was kind of like the opposite. It was kind of like a letdown ending to the album because it had never really faltered in its strong appeal, and yet I do think that Hate Tomorrow, especially being one of the weakest songs to end the album, was kind of strange. Maybe he didn't think it was a weak song, so.
I don't know how the order is selected, but it seems okay for me. I like this. Like I say, I'm just going to say I like the album. I did like the more upbeat songs and the ballads. I like the variety on it.
There is good variety. It flows very nicely.
And lyrically, definitely at least half the songs I found were really good. It varied from good to really good.
I hope people don't think that I'm knocking it, because I'm not. I'm just saying that it's a very good album. It's just not an album that I would buy. That doesn't mean anything. What I'm saying is that I would listen to this. I enjoyed listening to this. It's just meant for certain people that are not me.
Yes, panders to a different kind of audience.
Yes, and it did, and it would have if I was 18 years old in 1972 and 1973. This is the album your older brother likes, who's already got a job, and I'm not knocking that. I know that sounds derogatory, but that's just the way it is.
That's kind of the big problem I had last week with the James Taylor. And I have to mention this because it's been bugging me all week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, normally when an album's done that well and I respect the artist and I like the songwriting, I usually give it a bit higher. But with that one, I couldn't get past the music to enjoy the songs. The music was always that slick corporate pull me out of the song with distracting me by that particular music.
Right.
And the point I'm trying to make is he wrote that music for a particular audience. And there's other albums where I have, you know, said, okay, Teddy Pendergrass has written this for the ladies, but I still respect it. And on that one, I couldn't get past the music. And what was my point?
You made a real good point, though, Rob, in that making music for
a commercial purposes, yes,
a specific audience, I don't think Jim Croce is making music for a specific audience. I think this is just what comes out.
Yeah, I think this is just Jim Croce. James Taylor, I think he wrote songs the way James Taylor writes songs, but once it got into the studio and got that production on it.
I agree with you 100%.
100%. And my point is, I rated that one lower usually, like because I couldn't get into that type of music. It was...
Well,
it was
a distraction. It seemed very corporate in a way.
Oh, yeah, my point is, that's a definite prejudice of mine. It exists with that type of music, but not with other type of musics, even though maybe the result is the same and that I still recognize it's good.
I have a prejudice too. I have a prejudice because some of this is light. You know what I mean? Lightweight.
Yeah.
even though the songwriting's not light, but it's
I don't know whether to call it a preference or a prejudice. It's a
I don't know. That's true. That's a good point too. Very good point. I don't know whether it's a preference or a prejudice against that music because I don't like light music. I just don't. And yeah. I find that some of it is catered. But you know what? You know that it's all coming out of Jim Croce. You know that none of this is calculated to be a hit single. And that all of this is just him writing his songs and presenting to them. Yeah. He might have, if he lived longer, started to make albums like James Taylor that were more lush. We'll never know. But he could have, yeah. I think we both like this album. What was your rating?
I do. I actually gave it a 4. I really, really liked it.
That's cool. Yeah. We both like this album in different degrees, but we did like it. Okay?
Yes. I like his songwriting. You know, when Jim Croce's writing a song and singing it, there's an actual human being there.
You know,
who's has something to
say. I like that you said that. Let's end it with just saying, you know what? Jim Croce is not remembered because of just his airplane crash. He's remembered because he's a major talent.
Yeah.
And I found this out this week. And now I have no qualms about saying that for the rest of my life because Jim Croce is a major talent. If you get one song on the radio in a year and a half, you're a good songwriter. If you get like 5 or whatever that he got or 6, then you got something, man. You got a talent that's rare. And that's why it's so sad that it was so short. By the way, his son, AJ Croce, does very well as a jazz pianist and composer. He kind of went a different way than his dad, but he's very famous in his own right for what he does, and I find that very nice. Cool. So I think we broke the record for longest show of all time.
Oh, yeah. That's why I subtract the 2 minutes. There we go.
I think that was all that corporate thing we got into.
If they only yes wouldn't be yes, they wouldn't get me so riled up and I could do a regular length show.
And it's so late here doing this show, geez, people. I'm not going to get home till I don't know when because we still have to edit this. So.
Well, I'm glad I'm not working.
So that's all for today's show. Now, next week, we will have another fascinating album to talk about. We will be talking about that album for a long time on the show. Expect another hour and 20-minute show. And it's the last album in our theme of American commercial folk singer songwriters in the male category. And Rob, maybe also you would tell how you got wounded in the war.
That accident where I was repairing the elevator.
Yeah, but I warn you, people out there, he was hurt in a place that you probably don't want to know about.
Yeah, the elevator. The elevator.
So until then, we really got to go. So until then, take care and stay safe.
I just write her off. There we go. Why are we getting that buzz?
Well, I don't hear any buzz. Why do you say there's a buzz? I don't hear any buzz.